I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning into episode 182 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PR.fm, or download the MP3 after broadcast with iTunes or other podcast apps. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. If you like this show, please consider making a monthly donation at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. Former guest David Steffen and his wife Colette are in the news again. I interviewed him for a two-part episode back in January of 2017 over the death of their son Ezekiel, for which the parents were blamed, charged, and convicted. Now the Supreme Court of Canada has overturned the conviction. This is high stakes, with the prosecutor wanting a much harsher sentence for the parents, and the parents obviously wanting to be exonerated. And now let's go to an interview with Martin Barnes, who is organizing a conference which I will be attending and speaking at in the south of France in the middle of June. Martin Barnes is an American expat living in the south of France who will soon host a conference called the Challenging Avaricious Viral Paradigms. Martin established the first organic farm in the Capay Valley near Davis, California in his hippie days and raised four sons on the farm. And unfortunately, one died in a tragic accident, but the three surviving sons are now running Farm Fresh to You, which is the biggest community-supported agriculture in the world. Later in his life, Martin, for rather complicated reasons, translocated to the south of France, where he now runs a B&B. And Martin is with me today. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Yeah, hi, David. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, so I think organic agriculture is somewhat related to the viral paradigms, because often the alternative to a viral theory of disease is an environmental or nutritional theory of disease. And so the awareness in America and other places that the industrial agricultural model that was designed to maximize production wasn't necessarily the best model for producing the best food. That seems important, but what got you started with organic agriculture so many years ago?
My dad was a prof of entomology at UC Riverside.
Entomology and being insects.
Insects, yeah.
Right.
But I was a 4-H-er, and then I was interviewed at a program where I was talking about Rachel Carson's Silent Spring.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would get into fights with my dad, who would be recommending pesticides, but I would be saying, well, wait a minute, there must be a better way. And so then when I went to school at UC Davis, there was a really neat professor, Isao Fujimoto, and we ended up starting the first farmer's market in California, open-air farmer's market.
Mm-hmm.
And we started to sell produce by leasing. We rented a little bit of land from a neighboring farmer. He just let us have it. And so we never stopped selling because we were making money at the farmer's market. And later, when we were pregnant with the kids, the first two kids...
That was mostly your wife, right?
Yeah. And so there were twins. And so we thought, we want to raise these kids on a farm. And so mm-hmm. with the help of parents, we bought 20 acres in Capay Valley. And then we started a farm, selling at the farmer's market, and it went on from there.
And what kinds of things did you grow on the farm?
In California, you can grow about everything.
Right.
But melons, we kind of special. There's a thunderstorm going on here, sorry.
Yes.
We specialized in tomatoes, but you could do turnips, I mean, carrots, broccoli, cauliflower, just about anything. We had some nice, rich clay soil.
Right, right. And while you were at Davis, I mean, did you go to UC Davis to study?
Right. I got a master's degree in community development with Isao Fujimoto.
Oh, okay.
He was the one that turned us on to organic farming, or alternatives to agriculture, because UC is a big ag campus, but it's an agribusiness campus.
Right.
And we were saying, hey, wait a minute, there's better ways to do things than agribusiness.
Yes, well, agribusiness is a little bit more enthusiastic about organic now because they figure that they can turn it into a big business. back then, it was seen as a small business competing against monoculture, heavily fertilized, heavily pesticided farms.
And my sons are now competing against what's the guy who bought Whole Foods?
Yeah, that rather not very nice character who's the head of Whole Foods.
The Amazon guy.
Is Bezos? Is Jeff Bezos?
Yeah, Amazon bought Whole Foods.
Oh, I forgot about that. Okay.
So now my sons are competing with Amazon because they're getting into the door-to-door delivery business.
Right, right. Everybody is still doing that. I still like going to a store and picking out my own fruits and vegetables. So I don't know about this. I'd like to live in a village where I could just get on my bicycle and every day go down and pick up a few things for supper, but that's really hard in North America due to the design of cities. But while we're on this kind of random walk through your history, you also met Robert Crumb in UC Davis, and Robert Crumb has been a guest on my show before. He's a famous cartoonist, still active, although probably people would say his peak of his career was some decades ago, but he's never stopped.
Yeah, and he drew a wonderful virus to help us publicize our conference.
It's a pretty scary, it's the most scary virus that I've seen. It's not real, but it's scarier than most viral paradigms. So anyway, how did you meet Robert Crumb?
We were driving along a rural road in Davis, headed toward Davis, and this tall, thin guy with an old-fashioned hat and glasses was ringing a bell, just a tiny little bell. So we stopped, we said, can we help you? And he said, I would like a ride into Davis, please. And that's how I met Robert.
He was ringing a bell. Is this instead
bell.
Of sticking out his thumb?
Yeah.
Well, nobody can say that Robert Crumb follows fashion in any sense.
You visit his house. He has everything is old fashioned. There's an old fashioned record player. He has old fashioned clothes, and so he's very eccentric.
Yes.
But see, the interesting thing is that I randomly ended up in this town in the south of France, and then Robert moved to France too, and his village is only about an hour away.
Oh, okay. Okay, but and then somehow through Robert, you got a connection in the south of France.
Yeah, well, he was here one or two years before I arrived, and once I bought this house here on impulse, when I fell in love with the village, then I discovered that Robert wasn't that far away.
Mm-hmm. But you said that he got you a friend in this village or something like that. Through a mutual friend, you found this
village?
That's
correct. The mutual friend gave me a list of all of his relatives in France and their phone numbers and the name of the village. And so I happened to be in this village and then fell in love with it. I happened to have some money from when I split up with my wife, and I just fell in love with the village, and I just bought an old ruin on impulse.
Okay, and fixed it up yourself and turned it into a B&B?
That was in 1992, and then in 2004 I moved here, and that's when I met Monique, and together we started the B&B.
Oh, nice. And you're very close to the Pont du Gard, which is really one of the wonders of the world, I think.
Yeah, that's one thing that I realized when I bought the house, that this house has tourist potential.
It's running in your house.
And Monique is informing me that it's raining in the house and the window is leaking.
Do you need to go attend to that?
Oh, I don't think so. It's okay.
Okay.
Anyway, so this Pontu Guard is this incredible Roman...
I can do it.
Monique says, I can do it.
Okay. Well, I'm glad. I mean, if there's a weather crisis, we can always pause taping and keep going. But otherwise, it just adds to the authenticity of this interview.
So anyway, this Pontu Guard is incredible. It's like the pyramids. And the Romans built it 2,000 years ago.
Well, to be
out of stone.
Pont in French means bridge, but it's actually an aqueduct. Yeah. It's not truly a bridge. I mean, it's a bridge for water.
So it ran for 400 years, and there was water flowing along the top of that bridge from Uzès, 10 kilometers from me, to Nîmes, which is where the Roman headquarters was.
Right. And an aqueduct has to be built at a very slight incline. The water has to run downhill, but it can't run too far downhill because you have to go a long distance. So it needs to be precisely sloped.
Exactly.
And when it goes over the valley here, it's actually three tiers of arches.
Yeah. It has to make it across a canyon. That's what the Pontu Guard went across.
Right, and that's why there's a big bridge there, because the height of the aqueduct on one side and on the other side will only be slightly different.
Yeah.
I read in an article in Scientific American on the Pontu Guard many years ago, I don't know if it was the 1980s or something, that when they were building these bridges, they would take stones that would stick out while they were building it, and they would tie the scaffolding to these stones. And then when they were finished, they would chisel off the stones to produce a smooth front to make the thing look better. But the architect of this bridge decided to leave some of the stones on the frontage because he thought it was more aesthetically pleasing. It broke up the rather dull, smooth facade. It seems like it was an architectural genius who built this, and this was early AD, I assume.
Was done. It's like 2,000 years ago.
Yes.
A little more.
Yes.
And they decided, like in Nîmes was where the powerful people were. They wanted water.
Right.
There's water coming out of the ground in Uzès, and they decided that spring was 18 meters higher than Nîmes. But there's a row of mountains in between Uzès and Nîmes.
Right.
And so they had to build the aqueduct around the end of the mountains. And it was 48 kilometers long, and all they had was 18 meters of drop to deal with.
Right, so that has to have been extraordinarily precise. Yeah, like if you divide 18 meters by 48 kilometers, that slope is imperceptible to the eye. And yet it has to be there or the water will just not flow.
Those Romans were incredible engineers.
Yes, no kidding. And the Romans are related to viral paradigms because the Romans apparently believed in viruses, these invisible infectious agents. And the term virus is actually the Latin term for poison. In my talk, I will talk about how poison and contagion were really sort of treated in parallel back in the 1600s, probably based on Roman notions of disease, of explaining things they could not see or detect in any way.
Yeah, this is be one of the themes of the conference that's coming up in about 3 weeks. You know, what are viruses? Are they pathogenic? How do they measure them?
Right.
It turns out a lot of iffy stuff going on in these viruses that everyone believes in.
And it wouldn't be so bad believing in the viruses, but belief in viruses has negative consequences. Which include vaccines, which have adverse reactions, and antiviral drugs, which are some of the most toxic drugs. As I'm sure you know, what got you interested in viruses? I believe it was HIV was your first viral love.
The farm went through a financial crisis and my wife and I split up. And then I took up with a young Mexican girl. I lived in a trailer park in Davis. And she really wanted to get married. So she says, "Martin, we have to go get my green card." And so we applied. We got married at the courthouse. And then we applied for her green card, her visa. Then we had to wait and go through paperwork. And then we had to pretend that she was just coming into the country. So we flew to Puerto Vallarta. No, to Ciudad Juarez.
Mm-hmm.
And she was from Puerto Vallarta. She came in illegally, you know, across the fence.
Right.
And then met her in the trailer park, right? So anyway, we go through the procedure of her getting her green card, her visa, and then suddenly they said, we have bad news. The doctor says, Norma is HIV positive. My God, something, how's that to just throw a monkey wrench into your life?
Right,
Urine blot test. And he says, "Well, we'll do the test again." "Well, we did the test." "Oh, yes, she's HIV positive." Oh, my God. So we came back to Davis, and I was on the Kaiser Permanente program, and she is my wife, too. And so we go into Kaiser, and we take it very seriously. "Well, oh, she has HIV." And so they kept taking blood from her, more blood. That made her more angry. Every time we went in, they'd take all kinds of blood.
Right.
And then they would give her the medicines. And she'd start to take the medicines, and she'd get sick. And she was very spirited, okay?
Yes.
She says, "I'm not going to take this." And I said, "Norma, if you don't take these medicines, you're going to die."
Right.
And so we got into a fight at one point over this issue. And there's a small stab wound with a knife. And it didn't heal right away, and I wasn't really worried about it, but I went into Kaiser. And then the Kaiser doctor said, "You know, I'm required to report this to the sheriff. This is domestic violence." And then when I got back home, the sheriff cars were waiting, two of them. And then Norma came in on her bike, and they arrested her.
Arrested her for what? For stabbing you?
For stabbing me, yeah. They grabbed me. And they wanted to take pictures of the stab wound. And then they took her off to jail. And so I had to bail her out. And then she was supposed to take these violence training classes. And
right.
So we would try to go to class, you know, to get off. But she was just, "I hate those classes. I'm not going to take them." And the judge threw her back into jail.
Wow.
And then I would visit her in the jail, and then finally when she got out, she kind of found another boyfriend, and we split up, and then it was time for me to move to France, okay? And so I had to say goodbye to Norma, and we had an amicable divorce.
Right.
And then when I got to France, I heard an interview on Coast to Coast AM, but with Henry Bauer.
Right.
And he had just published his book. And I started to read it. And of course, you know, I come from an academic family. My father's a university professor. My two brothers are both scientists. My sister's married to one at UC Berkeley. And they're all telling me, "Martin, you know, AIDS thing, oh, don't believe this stuff." They're just very, and so, but still I would read it and it all started to make sense. And
they're talking, "Don't believe Henry Bauer."
"Don't believe Henry Darrett. I say, "Well, what should I?" What I became aware that there's a whole network of scientists and doctors who are skeptical about the whole HIV thing completely. And so I would try it on them, and they say, "Oh no, those guys are full of shit." But the more I got into it, the more sense it made, because then I started to read everything I could about it. And then the interesting thing happened. I happened to talk to Robert Crumb about it, who is living in the village. And it turns out he's into the whole thing, too.
And because Robert Crumb knew Christine Maggiore, who I would have loved to have on my show, but unfortunately she passed away before I started my show. But she had been diagnosed HIV positive as a young woman, and I think she lived 16 years or more before she died of mysteriously died of a pneumonia after taking an antibiotic. Okay, so anyway, Robert Crumb and AIDS.
And so Robert and I would talk to each other on the phone, and I would go visit him, and we'd start sharing information. And he had a whole row of books on, you know, AIDS skepticism. And we would start talking about it and sharing information. And that's when we, he attended the first conferences that we did in 2012 on this whole subject on AIDS skepticism. And I have a friend from Germany named George, he would help us too. So that's how to me, it was amazing that Robert was happened to be into the same line of thought that I was, and we were amazed when we discovered that with each other.
Yeah, it's funny how your lives have kind of intersected in all these different ways. Did you ever find out what happened to Nancy, your former wife?
So Norma, her brother, when Norma and I lived together in the trailer park, her brother also came across the fence or across the border, and he stayed with us briefly. He was only high school. But anyway, he since has returned to Puerto Vallarta, and then he emerged on Facebook. He started to contact me on Facebook. And he said, oh, Norma's doing fine. She's fine. Oh, the reason why she tested positive for HIV was she was doing the methamphetamines, okay? That was her favorite drug when I knew her.
Okay.
And so that's one of the things that made me a skeptic. I think, aha, that's why she tested HIV positive.
People think there's a big correlation between drugs and HIV because of injections of drugs. But there's actually a big connection between, say, cocaine and HIV seropositivity, even if you're not injecting cocaine. And I guess meth is never injected, right? I'm not really a...
Well, okay. She called it Cristal. And you put a little bit of it on a Coke can, and then you inhale with next to a nail hole, and then you put a lighter and you inhale from the opening of the Coke can, and so it's a smoke, and that's what the Mexicans call Cristal.
Okay.
And so she was into that, and I found that then I found out later, okay, that's why she tested HIV positive. And so anyway, it's interesting in my story. You can see how this threw a monkey wrench into my life.
Right.
And how
this is relatively minor compared with other people's, right? But still, I mean, when your relationship is turned upside down.
Organized this conference in 2012, and I'm organizing another one this time, because the mainstream, they just say, oh, no, you guys are denialists. You guys are full of it. Yet when you try to argue with them, they always cut off the argument. They don't want to have the dialogue because the science is on our side.
Yeah, I was just, and anecdotal information too. I was just contacted by a woman who's said I've been positive for 10 years. That my husband is negative, and the doctors cannot give me a good explanation for how this can be. 10 years with a man who's still negative, with unprotected sex, and he's still negative, and I'm positive. There's lots of this which cannot really be explained, and I don't know. Have your relatives tried to explain this kind of anomaly?
Well, no, they don't want to talk about it with me. I try to challenge them, and only one of them has decided to take up a scientific dialogue with me, and then he cut off the dialogue at a certain point.
Yes.
And so they think I'm crazy, though. They all think I'm crazy.
Yes. Well, I'm sure if you were in the village of Vers in the south of France 500 years ago and you decided to take up the question of whether God existed, that you would have had a similar reaction. Maybe they would have had more final solutions for you. They might have strung you up on the nearest tree or something, but their basic reaction to how can you question this dogma would have been the same. And it's kind of sad that science in some of these areas has become a dogma. It's not that, you know, the question is, you know, of all the things that are said about HIV, which of them are true? It's a question of they're all true, and you have people on the other side like Peter Duisberg and Henry Bauer who are basically saying that the vast majority are false. So there's not much middle ground on these viral paradigms. It either is or it isn't. So what got you interested in other viruses other than HIV?
Yeah, okay, so when we, I kind of became a student of the whole viruses, okay, and so I would start listening to This Week in Virology. It's a podcast out of Columbia University.
TWIV. I've listened to a few episodes myself, but I don't have the fortitude to listen to it all.
Yeah, but I would listen on a regular basis and just to learn about the science of virology, thinking, well, how, because I come from a university background, I think, you know, these guys have to be wrong on a technical basis, and so I have to learn the technology. And so it's a very obscure technology, virology. There's lots of terms that are used that the English means one thing, but the reality is something different. And so you have to learn the ins and outs of it. And so that's one thing that I've done. And it's interesting that there's a group in Australia who say, you know, they never even proved that the virus HIV exists. And so I really got interested in that. And I've decided that, you know, they've never matched up the viral genome. In other words, they can measure sequences of what they say are the virus, but they've never matched up what the sequences of that they say is the virus with an electron microscope, a picture of what is the virus. And so we're really not sure.
Yes.
We're really not sure what they're talking about.
Well, yeah, I mean, there needs to be kind of a chain of custody, right? Like, logically you would purify the virus and you would put it under an electron microscope just to ensure purity. But once the material's put under an electron microscope, you can't do anything with it because the process of putting it under an electron microscope destroys it. But if you take half the sample and put half the sample under the electron microscope, you can say, okay, this is composed of identical particles, but we don't know what those particles are. You cannot tell that from an electron microscope. So then the other half, you could then sort of break it down into constituents, which would basically be proteins and RNA. And then you could sequence the RNA, and you could say, okay, well, this RNA comes from these particles. And these proteins probably form the shell and the sort of the superstructure of the particle. And so if you take 100 people who have AIDS, and you from each of them you can purify it, and from each of them you get the same RNA and the same proteins, then you could say, okay, we've proven at least that the same virus is present in all of these people. But they've never got even to first base on this.
Right, and so what they're doing is that they're using the signature of the sequences and saying, this is HIV. And so the whole thing is based on these sequences. And then when they do the viral load, they look for just certain parts of the sequence and they say, oh, well, that sequence is there and that must be HIV, the virus. But
well,
they never match
It's worse than that because they say that HIV mutates really quickly. So it's not like there is a single genome that they can say, we're looking for this single genome. And besides, you know, the fact is that they did not obtain this genome from purified particles. So they don't actually even know that the genome they're looking at is viral. And for anybody to say that we know exactly what the DNA in your body is doing, and the RNA in your body is doing, that's going way beyond the evidence. There was recently a study that looked at healthy older people, and it examined their genome, looking for well-known genetic defects that are, you know, like fatal diseases. And they found that a lot of these healthy older people were carrying the genes that were believed to be of fatal illnesses. And so that basically says, I mean, they were looking at it from the point of view, should we be doing genetic testing? And what they're saying is, like, these people lived a healthy life without this fatal disease. So if we go around genetic testing everybody, we're going to tell everybody they've got some kind of a fatal genetic illness or not. But it also says...
This whole genetic thing with the doctors, it's not working out like they thought.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Angelina Jolie who cut off her own breasts because the doctors told her that she was carrying a gene for breast cancer. I mean, was she? I mean, we will now never know, of course, whether she would have got breast cancer. But sadly, there's going to be a lot more of that, you know, with DNA tests down to like $100.
Yeah.
I just saw a little news program which took some identical triplets and quadruplets and sent in their DNA for looking at their ancestry, and in some cases came up with considerably different results. You know, similar results, but, you know, one member of one triplet was told that she had some Scandinavian blood and her two sisters had none. You know, obviously, there is a certain degree of inaccuracy here, and there's a lot more that we don't know about genetics than we do know.
Anyway, when I started to study viruses and become kind of a student of virology, I became aware that there's a certain number of very smart professors who think the virologists are crazy. And so I'm wondering, God, is it true? And so... then you begin to, I mean, there's been, I saw some credible review that the whole 1918 flu, maybe that was caused by a lot of different things, like vaccinations that they were giving at the time, and not this particular nasty flu virus. And then I started to get involved in polio, and I started to read polio books, and it turns out, you know, you get the same symptoms of polio from poisoning, you know, heavy metal poisoning or pesticide
poisoning,
and then this latest Zika thing. Well, they haven't really proved that Zika causes these birth defects, and then there's the HPV thing, and they haven't proved that HPV really causes that cervical cancer.
Right, and not only that, but they have no evidence that the vaccine will prevent a single case of cervical cancer.
And there's rumors that 200 or 300 young women have been killed by the vaccine, and you know, many more have been injured.
Well, some statistics in Sweden show that there is a rise in the incidence of cervical cancer amongst young women, which is the group that has been vaccinated. Now, some people have pointed out that some of that younger group were people who had not plausibly been vaccinated because they were a little bit too old. But the fact that the rate of cervical cancer is rising in young people and not in older people while they're vaccinating younger people should be cause for concern. But we seem to be living in an autocracy where those kinds of questions are simply not allowed. The mainstream...
Yeah, no, the more Yeah, the more you get into this, the more you realize that even though certain things have been proven scientifically and medically, like for instance, vitamin C and high doses can be used for a lot of different cures, the profession doesn't adopt that. Even though it's reality, it takes like 20 or 30 years for them to get it together to pick up on something, you know, that was learned a long time ago. It's just really strange.
Yes. There are a lot of things, and a lot of these things are being discussed at your conference. Like, one of the people at the conference who I've also interviewed is Joan Shenton, who her trilogy on HPV, Sacrificial Virgins, talked about some of these young women whose lives were turned upside down after vaccination. And although there's never any proof, absolute proof that a vaccine caused disease, when a healthy young woman has no other plausible explanation for a sudden onset of illness, one has to look at the vaccine. And there seems to be a significant commonality in the symptoms. And also with the new types of aluminum in the vaccines, there's some scientific plausibility to having new side effects.
It's amazing. I'd like to listen to Gary Null. And so his latest thing is that, you know, there's a difference between science, which is based on almost a religion called scientism.
Right.
And evidence-based medicine, which is just based on the actual research results and the reality out there. And it turns out that these doctors and scientists, they're all into they have to believe into the system, even though the evidence is contrary, or they close their minds to listening to anything contrary.
Yeah, well, it is a very hierarchical system. And I mean, it's a little bit like being in the military, I think, and you know, you're trained and you're trained on the technology of the military, how to fire a gun, how to aim it, how to use different weapons, things like that. You sort of focus on that, and maybe as you get older and you start to see, you know, what happens in wars, maybe you have a bit of a crisis of conscience. But now you have a decision, because you know that if you go forwards and say, you know, I don't think war is making the world more peaceful, that your career in the military is going to be over, and in fact, you may end up in jail or in exile. And that's very similar to what happens to a medical professional when they start to question some of the fundamental tenets of, say, virology. You're going to lose your position. You're going to be ridiculed in the media. You know, all kinds of bad things will happen to you, as we've seen with some of these people.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about some of your other guests at this conference? Like, you have...
Yeah, there's a guy coming. He didn't want his last name mentioned, but he's French, and he's aware of this whole thing, that, you know, all these facts that show that the whole HIV thing is a scam, but he can't figure out why it hasn't been adopted. And so he's a sociologist.
Okay.
And so he's here to give a talk on the sociology of the science space, as he describes it.
Well, it's important to it's important to understand how to study scientists. How can it be that they all think the same on this issue, or 99.9%, and is consensus, as they often say with climate science? You know, 97% of climate scientists believe in anthropogenic global warming. To me, that's a completely irrelevant statement, because that doesn't speak to the truth of the theory. I mean, at the time of Einstein's development of the theory of relativity, you could probably have got, you know, 100% of other scientists to agree that Einstein's ideas were crazy, that time would slow down as you moved faster, that gravity could bend light. Like, all of these things, I'm sure you could have got every physicist in that day to say, you're crazy, this is ridiculous. And yet, eventually, one man was able to change physics radically. But it is interesting how these orthodoxies are imposed and how much of it is based on thoughtful reasoning and how much of it is just based on, well, my brethren in science all believe this, therefore I will believe it. What about Dr. Nancy Dominguez, I think from Chile?
Yeah, she's from Spain. Maybe Chile, I'm not sure.
No, she's from Latin America for sure.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's right. She's going to be giving a talk. I'm not sure what about, but she's part of the dissidents. And Marco Ruggiero, we're going to try to connect with him on Skype.
Right.
So he was a university professor in Italy.
Yeah, University of Florence.
And he was saying this whole HIV thing really doesn't make sense, but then they didn't like that, and so he migrated to Colorado.
Or Arizona. Anyway, yeah, doesn't really matter. I mean, Marco Ruggiero is an example of somebody who has extremely high academic credentials. He's published a lot. He was a molecular biologist. No problem at all with his career until he started to go after, does HIV cause AIDS? And then, you know, things started to turn sour for him. And there was a real attack on his position at university. And like you say, he decided life was better in America for free thinking. Another scientist with very heavy credentials is Christel Meyer, who I believe is from Austria. So what can you say about her?
Yeah, I don't know that much about her, but I'm looking forward to her presentation.
Yeah, epigenetics from HIV to immunization, new prospects on health and disease. And epigenetics is how basically things outside of our genome can be inherited. You also have an interesting talk from a guy from South Africa, Karim Raji, Alternative, Safe, Efficacious, and Economical New Age Treatment for the Management of AIDS. I'm a little skeptical because I agree that the individual diseases of AIDS exist, but I'm skeptical that they are in any way related except by this term HIV that we created. But it's going to be interesting to hear what he says. Do you know much about him?
Well, just the announcement in the conference is all I know. It's interesting that in the announcement he says maybe some of these diseases don't, some of these, you know, signs of HIV don't even need to be treated. In other words, I think he was giving a hint that
he is a
skeptic about the whole thing. But
yes, it's one thing when I'm contacted by in my work, unpaid work as the head of Rethinking AIDS, I often get emails from people saying, I'm HIV positive, I don't want to take the drugs, but what should I do? And my first question is, well, are you actually ill? Because some people become diagnosed HIV positive because they have a health crisis. They go to the doctor and they say, you're HIV positive, this is the cause of your illness. But other people might just have an HIV test because they're starting a new relationship or something. They have no health problems at all. But even when they reject the antiretroviral drugs, they still believe, well, I've got to do something because obviously I'm immune suppressed because I've got a positive HIV test and my CD4 counts are low. But the evidence, the scientific evidence, doesn't really support that.
Yeah, there's, besides cocaine or drugs, there's 80 different normal conditions or illness conditions that can make you test HIV positive on an antibody test.
A lot of them are not, I wouldn't call them as illnesses. Like pregnancy is not an illness, although it's treated as an illness by, if you have a baby in a hospital. And also vaccines. Some vaccines can stimulate the antibodies. They get mistaken for HIV
antibodies. You can have a flu shot, then that can make you test HIV positive. Then you're freaked out, your whole life changes. And the doctors are letting this go on. It's just outrageous.
But this is their model, right? Like I like to use a military model because, you know, why does everybody care so much about Iran, for example? Just pick Iran. Well, you know, people say, well, they might produce a nuclear bomb. Clearly, the evidence for this has been exaggerated. But, you know, it might be a reasonable concern if it wasn't for the fact that really, when peace breaks out, the share prices of military industrial contractors go down. So if you look at it from a point of view of military industrial complex, is the military industrial contractors need wars to sell weapons. They don't necessarily need a hot war. They're quite happy to sell weapons that never get used, but they need to sell them. And if the war in Iraq eventually does grind to a halt and Iraq kind of stumbles forwards as a somewhat more peaceful country without the need for outside intervention, then there's going to have to be weapons sold somewhere else. And, you know, Iran is a nice, tasty target if you're a military contractor. Do the people who own shares in Lockheed Martin really want to get peace? Do the people who own shares in big cancer pharmaceutical companies really want to cure cancer? That would destroy their business.
Yeah. When you learn that this is kind of an example of something going on where what they say just isn't true, or what everyone believes isn't true, and then you realize that it's going on in a lot of different areas also, like, you know, what's behind the whole 9/11 thing. Mm-hmm. And then even these scientific theories like the Big Bang, you know, there's a lot of skepticism about that's how everything began, you know.
Yes,
but you have to must be the Big Bang, you know. But wait a minute, there's a whole block of scientists who are saying, wait a minute. And so but the media controls what they want everyone to believe. And once you get into
it's not just the media.
Strange how...
Like when Halton Arp started to criticize the Big Bang theory, he was a well-known astronomer in California, and he lost his telescope time, and he was basically forced to relocate to Europe in order to have any chance to follow his practice. But that was a case where the scientists were closing ranks, and they were expelling a heretic.
It's still happening. Like, there's this guy, James McKenney, I like to listen to, but he doesn't exist on Wikipedia, even though he's a really well-known scientist among the whole alternative community, at least people that are astronomers. Yet the whole, like at NASA, he's a persona non grata.
Mm.
Even though a lot of things I think he's making a lot of sense on a lot of things that he says.
Well, it seems to me that these heretics, even if they're wrong, could smarten up the game of the other scientists. But it seems like the other scientists are kind of comfortable. There's a lot of science that goes on that really is done completely within the boundaries of acceptable thought, and is in no danger of expanding the boundaries of science, expanding the bounds of knowledge. The kinds of experiments that go on with AIDS is like, if we give people a brochure on condoms versus personal counseling, are they more likely to use condoms? I mean, there's lots of that kind of research that goes on that you know, in no way is ever going to challenge the HIV/AIDS theory, and in no way is going to challenge our understanding of science in any way.
Yeah, but the scientists get their grants renewed.
That's, of course, what counts. And if you're successful in getting a grant for that, then the next thing is going to be, well, let's do the same thing with taking antiretroviral drugs? Are people more likely to be compliant if we counsel them in this way or that way? And then when you've got that, then you kind of move it a little bit, and you can basically, it's kind of like Brownian motion. You have to move in order to get grants. You can't apply for the same grant application time after time. So it has to be slightly different enough, but if you make it too different, you'll be denied funding because you've gone outside the boundaries of acceptable discourse.
Yeah. But there's a whole alternative universe of like the whole natural food thing, organic food thing, and then like a guy rang the bell yesterday, and he was a naturopathic practitioner here in the village, and I didn't even know he was around. there's a whole phalanx of alternative medicine, and so if people just kind of plug into that network and stay away from the mainstream guys, they'd be a lot better off.
Yes, I think one of the problems with alternative medicine is often they're not very educated on the challenges. I mean, that's certainly not always true, but quite often they're not very well educated on the challenges to the underlying mainstream medical paradigms, and they also don't necessarily have the courage to openly challenge modern medicine, because you will be savagely attacked. I'm not saying they're cowards. I'm saying they're realists. That if they have a nice business as a naturopath or a chiropractor, and they have thoughts about the basic concepts of allopathic medicine, they could lose everything if they go out and challenge it. They would lose their medical practice.
Yeah.
Another interesting person you have speaking is John Lauritsen, who is a gay man who was around at the start of the AIDS era in New York City, I believe, and became a real advocate against poppers, which are the nitrite inhalants that were very prevalent in the gay community and not widely used among heterosexuals as drugs.
Yeah, that's great. He's going to be our keynote speaker.
Yes.
And we're looking forward to what he has to say. And also at the end of the conference, we're going to have a strategy session of, wait a minute, what can we do? Obviously, our strategy to try to change this paradigm hasn't been working. We don't seem to have made much progress.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to try to figure out what's going on. So there's some interesting people that have been involved in the dissident movement that will be participating in that. Then we're also having a session, kind of a roundtable session, on what are alternative treatments for people that have a challenged immune system or suffering from another, what they say is a viral illness. And so there's quite a few alternative practitioners. Like one guy is saying, hey, you know how important vitamin D is? He's going to give a presentation just on vitamin D. So,
yes,
that's what we'll be up to.
Yes, there are a lot of interesting talks. I think there are kind of two tracks when we're talking about medical paradigms. There are the criticizing the paradigm. Maybe this isn't really a disease at all. But then in other times it is, well, there is a disease, but the cause might not be viral. And those are both important, because there definitely are people who were diagnosed, say, with HIV because they were sick. And those people need some hope outside of antiretroviral drugs. On the same hand, people who are positive for a virus, who have no illness, need to have some comfort that the scientific evidence says if you do nothing but live a normal, healthy life, and maybe a healthy life isn't normal, but if you do nothing but live a healthy life, you're probably going to be okay. And so those are two diverse but important things. We're kind of coming to the end of our time, so is there anything else you'd like to say about this conference? Yeah. We didn't give the dates. It's going to be June.
There's a party in the evening of Friday, June 15th, and then it'll go for the Saturday and the Sunday after that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want more information, you have to send me an email. And my first name is Martin, and my email is flatmartin@yahoo.com.
I thought it was gmail.com.
Well, I also have flatmartin@gmail.com, whichever one you want.
Okay, so flatmail at either gmail.com or yahoo.com. Okay, well, that's good.
Flatmartin, yeah.
Right, and is that flat because you're flat or because you have an apartment?
Okay, the newspaper I used to publish in Davis was called The Flatlander because in Davis, California, everything is flat. We don't have mountains there.
Right. I remember reading a book which was trying to talk in humorous terms about one and two dimensional worlds and the challenges of living in a flat or two dimensional world. And of course, a one dimensional world is even more difficult because if there's two of you on a string, it's impossible to get past each other. So you have a very restricted life. This has been a great discussion. I'm looking forward to seeing you in Vers, Pointe-du-Gard, in the south of France. And I'm looking forward to giving my talk on viruses at your conference. And thank you for organizing it.
Okay, well, thanks. Thanks for interviewing me.
Yes, this will be up soon. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 182 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. And if you can, go to the Challenging Avaricious Viral Paradigms Conference in the south of France. I'll see you there, and you can listen to my talk. And if not, then I will give you a summary of my talk, which I hope will be very interesting, covering a couple of diseases that don't get talked about a lot, but are historically important. I will cover that on a future episode of the show. Until next week, thank you, and goodbye.